Schools and Public Affairs today, May 15, 2003, and members, we're going to be looking for a public hearing first on House Bill 3130. We'll then have a public hearing on House Bill 3627, and at some point, I'm hoping between 2 and 3 o'clock, we will return to a work session on 3130. And so with that, let's open up the public hearing on House Bill 3130. Mr. Nelson and Mr. Gilliam. And colleagues, I think you had an amendment sent to you at your offices. It's the -1 amendment. And that is the topic of discussion today. We are not privatizing the OLCC. Mr. Gilliam?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're here for the record, Joe Gilliam, representing the Oregon Grocery Association. The issue here is what we call alternatives. The beverage sold in stores that are flavored malt beverages, and what has been created is kind of a different kind of alcohol from a beer or from a wine or from any other kind of alcohol. They've been in stores for over 30 years. And sold under various names and flavors such as wine coolers and Mike's Hard Lemonade, Smirnoff Ice, things like that, that are on the shelves. The federal government this year sent a letter down to the OLCC advising the OLCC that many of these beverages may not be in compliance with state statute. And we are now looking for a resolution as the federal government considers a new formula and new regulation to be used nationwide. While it would only be a guideline on the states, it would really be the market rule, if you will, and that is out prospectively from us. And so we're looking at a change right now that will get us through the time in which the federal government will act, impose a new rule, that we can come back at a later time and adopt that standard, but keep the products on the shelves until such time as that happens. We don't have a date certain, as you can imagine, with federal rulemaking. There's no, could be tomorrow, could be 10 months from now. And we've been working with other people in the industry trying to find a compromise, and I believe we've done it with amendments that will be coming from LC shortly.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Mark Nelson representing 7-Eleven and Anheuser-Busch. And I emphasize the two clients because they're in conflict with each other over this issue. And it has not been fun for the last 3 months. Just a little brief background. I've passed out to you a little piece on the alternatives. These products were always felt to be coming under the definition of malt beverage because they are malt produced. It has, with review by both feds and the OLCC, it was determined that they are in violation of the other definition, which defines alcoholic beverage as any liquid or solid containing more than 0.5%. They may be malt based, but they have a higher percent and therefore are alcoholic beverage, alcoholic liquor. So we're faced with removing these products from the stores, which obviously 7-Eleven did not want to do, as well as Joe's clients. Our goal in this whole process was, how do we allow malt-based products to be sold in the grocery store while at the same time establishing and continuing to establish the very clear line of what is distilled spirits and what is not, and that's the 1.5%, 0.5%. Joe has mentioned the federal side in terms of their rulemaking, and that controls federal taxation. In Oregon, because we're a controlled state, our definition not only controls taxation, but also controls distribution and point of sale. So we were faced with, at what point do we require enforcement by OLCC? OLCC has initially said they need to be out of the stores by July 1, 2003. Working with OLCC, they extended that to January 1, 2004. In other words, they would not enforce the present standard of what we call the 0.5% or 1%. It's also called 90-10. They would not enforce that standard until that date. That doesn't work for the grocery industry. So in trying to work a balance, we came up with what we thought was a compromise, which was the enforcement, or the date the federal government makes their announcement of the rule. In further discussions and negotiations today, we have come to an agreement on the December 31st, 2004. Date, and we think that will work. From obviously from 7-Eleven, they heartily would endorse that approach. From Anheuser-Busch's point of view, they would not oppose that compromise. They want to make it clear that they are willing to comply with OLCC statute that requires them to reformulate their product to bring it below 0.5%, so it is again a malt beverage, and we are doing that as we speak. We have committed that our position will remain the same on the Senate side, that we will support this bill, in other words, we will not oppose the bill and move forward with it. Unless, of course, Mr. Chairman, if amendment is added in the Senate that changes this compromise, we would oppose it.
Okay, questions? Representative Monis Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, I thought you were saying that the amendment lists July 1st, 2005, and yet you were talking about December 31st, 2004.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, Representative Morris Anderson. That amendment has not arrived. We reached the agreement a couple hours ago. It should be here, we believe, by 2 o'clock. It is that pretty much that amendment, but changing the date to December 31st. And there may be a couple tweaks, words, but it's 2004.
Further questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. And, Mr. Chairman, thanks for your help on putting this together.
Very
much.
Anyone else to testify on this bill?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll close the public hearing then on House Bill 3130. And colleagues, as I had stated at the beginning, we will await those amendments. Hopefully we'll see them before we're through by 3 o'clock today and go back into work session. Let's then open up a public hearing on House Bill 3627.
When I go fall upstairs, but there's not a whole lot in that, so it doesn't matter.
Well, we'll find it in there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Colleagues, committee, we'll stand at ease. Okay. Returning on the record of House Rules and Public Affairs Committee, and colleagues, before we take on 3627, with your indulgence, we will go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 3130. And we had not had the amendment completed by LC. There's a mix-up in communication on that. We do have legislative counsel here advising us that we ought to just go forward with a conceptual amendment, since all we're doing is changing the date of the Dash 1 amendment. So with that, Representative Flores.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that we suspend the rules for conceptual amendments to House Bill 3130.
Okay. Representative Flores has moved that we suspend the rules for conceptual amendments. Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Flores. Mr. Chair, I move to change the Dash 1 amendments to insert a new date on line 10, striking July 1, 2005, inserting December 31st, 2004, as well as on line 11, replacing the July date with the December 31, 2004 date.
Okay. Representative Flores has moved the conceptual amendment to the Dash 1's, House Bill 3130, changing the date on line 10 from July 1, 2005 to December 31, 2004, and then on line 11 from July 1, 2005 to December 31, 2004. And any discussion on any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the amended Dash 1 amendments.
Representative Flores has moved adoption of the the amended Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 3130. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3130 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores has moved House Bill 3130 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Representative Barnhart.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just realized I have a question. And the question is, what happens with this if the federal, whoever it is, Federal Trade Commission, comes up with their plan before December 31st, 2004?
Mr. Gilliam and Mr. Nelson.
I'm just trying to understand how these different things fit together.
It's Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, it's a good question because we don't know what the date will be. You know, you have several different scenarios that can happen. We have two scenarios. If the federal government, which is, I think, the most likely to do, is to make a 90-10 standard, or the one half of 1%, then it's pretty much seamless. Because we'd fall behind the standard. Oregon wouldn't be any different than any other state. It matches up with our current statute, and we just go along doing business as we always did. If in the off chance they went to a different standard, a different mixture, during that time period, then we would be status quo until the 31st, 12/31/04, which at that time we'd have to come back to the legislature to say, we're out of step with the federal standard. We'd like to correct that at that time. So basically, this gives us a safeguard to get us to 12/31/04, because we just don't know what that date will be when the feds act. And it'll most likely be seamless, and you'll never have to talk about a flavored malt beverage again.
We hope.
We hope.
Promise?
No.
I have one other.
Representative Monis Anderson.
Thank you. What is the difference between the tax on a malt beverage? What is the tax, I should say, on a malt beverage, and what is the tax on an alcoholic beverage?
You know, I'm not going to tell you the exact tax.
Is it significant?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morris Anderson, you, of course, have federal taxes and you have state taxes.
I was just thinking of state.
In state, your tax on beer is $2.60 per barrel. Oregon doesn't have, quote, a tax on distilled spirits. We have a markup, and I believe that's 105%.
105%, I believe.
It's 105% of what?
Of the wholesale price.
Wholesale.
It's It's a different system than the tax system, which what throws everybody off.
Okay. Further questions? Nobody wants to privatize the OLCC? Okay, just checking.
makes us too much money.
That's right. Yeah. Good to see you asking me this here.
Okay. In the room.
No further discussion. Let's call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Well, aye.
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 Chair votes aye. And I don't know that we need a carrier on this. What do we?
Consent calendar?
I think consent calendar is fine. Without objection, so ordered. And House Bill 3130 will move to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. And that closes the work session on House Bill 3130. And it will we will open up a public hearing on House Bill 3627. Senator Morris.
Yeah, you're right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Frank Morris. I'm a state senator from District 8, which is the area of Albany and Corvallis in the counties of Lynn and Benton. I'm here to testify in favor of this bill, and I would like to thank the committee chairman for taking Senate Bill 333 and bringing it back in the House as House Bill 3627. I'd like to maybe just briefly look at some information I think is relevant to this whole issue. That has to do with what has happened within our state from the period of 1992 to the year 2000. We have experienced with respect to state spending an increase of 68.9%. With respect to per capita state and local spending, all spending combined, we've increased 52.7%, while you've had an inflation rate of 16.4%. So these are somewhat alarming figures. The result of all this is that Oregon ranks 49th highest out of 50 states in the percent change in state spending, which means that of the 50 states of that time period from 1992 to the year 2000, we have had the 49th highest rate of change increase in state spending. We're 47th in percent change in state and local spending. And we're 40th, and at the year 2000, we were 40th in state spending and 44th in state and local spending. The per capita, and if you look at adjusting it for population, the per capita state and local spending in the year 2000, we ranked 44th highest at $7,040 per person. The per capita state spending total expenditures, state and local, we were the 40th highest at 46, just state spending, we were the 40th highest at $4,611 per person. These are statistics that have come to haunt us today in the fiscal problems that we are now experiencing. And I guess the question would be, what does this have to do with House Bill 3627? And I think it has a lot to do with it. And it has to do with the question of what should drive our fiscal decisions. Should resources, revenue, drive those decisions, or should demand drive those decisions? Well, actually, it's a combination of both. It's hard to isolate those issues. But what we've had during that eight-year period, those statistics, we've had a process of current service level financing, where you roll up costs. And so with respect to this bill as it relates to state government, we're looking at changing that dynamic of current service level funding to looking at what are the available funds and then working within the context of those funds as you determine what we would provide with respect to collective bargaining agreements with our state employees. With respect to the K through 12 side of the equation, what we had was we had Measure 5. And Measure 5, as we all know, transferred funding from local, which was controlled. People at the local level had an idea of what their resources would be, and they managed their expenses within those resources. After Measure 5, there was a fundamental shift. Two-thirds of the resources then became the responsibility of the state of Oregon. And you then had K through 12 making commitments without knowing in advance, without knowing what their resources were. So it creates a dynamic within our state that, quite frankly, I don't think it works very well. And that's the intent of this bill, is to change that dynamic so that you're actually operating within the resources that are available. We've heard anecdotally, and it's not totally anecdotally, but you've heard of labor commitments and agreements that have been made in the context of declining revenues within K through 12 that has been business as usual when we've had declining state revenues. This bill would change that process, and it would still allow and provide for collective bargaining, but it would be in the context of what is available from the state. And we know that that's not an endless supply of money, and we certainly know that now. So I believe this is it's a fairly significant policy shift. We would not have the commitments that are made at state level prior to the determination of our budget. We would not have the final commitments made at the K through 12 level with respect to labor commitments without knowing what the resources are that these districts have to work with. So it's a very simple bill. I think it would have a profound change positively in how we manage the resources of this state. And I thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, sir. Questions? Representative Miles Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing this bill forward, Senator. But I would like to make a statement regarding, or a response to the statement that regarding the state spending that we have here, I forget what number, but in the 40s. And I think it's important for all of us to realize that we have, 198 school districts, and 98 of them have only 6% or 6 or 7% of the students in the state. So that means we have many, many, many small school districts, and small school districts cost more. We had a bill the other day where Ione really wants to keep its identity, and they are going to be getting 1.2 or 1.4 million. When you take that amount of money and divide it by the 160 students that they have, that comes to be about over $7,000 per student for that district. And then Morrill County then had, I forget, six thousand something per student. So I think that even though our spending might be high, because we're such a rural state, I think that's where most of the expense is, and I wish we could let the public know that also. Anyway, that's just a comment. Nothing against your bill, for sure, but just that comment.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Flores.
Thank you, Senator Morrison. Just as a specific detail, we were you listed Oregon as 49th highest in the rate of change of state spending, and what's one state above or below us, depending on your perspective?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Flores, I ran out of the office. I do have that study. I would be happy to provide that to the committee, at least the excerpts from that study, if you would be interested. I think it was Massachusetts.
Or Mississippi. Maybe. One of those and ones. Thank you. Interesting statistics.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I read your the bill, it would essentially mandate that contracts not be any longer than 2 years. Is that right? I mean, assuming you signed it immediately after the budget were adopted here, it couldn't extend past the end of the biennium that you were in.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart, I'm not certain that it necessarily mandates that. It would, I think, to the extent that you are making financial commitments. There are many issues in a collective bargaining agreement that, you know, could survive beyond 2 years. You could have, you know, a two-year cycle with respect to compensation and those kinds of benefits. Yes, I think it would put that into a two-year cycle. This bill would cause some a little bit of heartache and grief for K through 12. Would it require them to adjust the way that it would take some time to get through to get into a cycle? But I quite honestly just don't understand how commitments can be made when they don't know what the resource availability is going to be from the state. In discussing this with a superintendent friend of mine, he doesn't happen to be in my district, but he was quite favorably disposed to this kind of concept because he said he's very handicapped when he's forced to make commitments out into the future and not knowing what we are going to provide him at the state level. I don't see this bill in any way, shape, or form as being, you know, an attempt to undermine collective bargaining or to denigrate the value of our public employees in any way, shape, or form. I think it puts back into this body the responsibility that truly is ours as to how are we going to fund it, at what level, and we make those commitments, and then they are executed at the local level, as opposed to the local level creating commitments for us and then bringing it back to us and saying, you have to fund these issues. To me, that's just fundamentally backwards.
Further questions? Representative Berger.
Yes, Senator Morris, I have to agree with you, but a little bit of a different take, and that is that it's so unfair to the schools. You know, they try to run their schools like a business, and when they don't know what they're going to have, it makes it very difficult for them to look efficient, and then they are criticized. So I think it puts them in a bad position. I guess the one thing that worries me is that all of the little pieces are coming to me in parts, like a big puzzle. And if I could put it all together, the red schoolhouse would jump out of the picture. But we can't make decisions about our schools this way. We have declining schools in my district. Yeah, up in the suburban areas, they have growing schools. They are, and both of these situations are critical to our school people. And yet, I've been here since January, and we still aren't having any of the discussion as to how we're going to help these two situations in Oregon educate our children. So I'm very much in favor of letting schools know what they have to spend, but I am frustrated, I have to tell you, in being able to put this puzzle together for the benefit of our children in Oregon.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, I share that frustration. Being a new legislator, this process just seems to be painfully slow and not very efficient in really coming to grips with these issues. And I do have confidence that we will before we adjourn. Obviously, we will come to grips, but I concur with your assessments.
Okay. Representative Backlund.
Thank you, Chair Doyle. Senator Morris, as a point of curiosity, the bill pertains to state government and to school districts. Did you deliberately exclude, like, counties, cities, special taxing districts? Was that an oversight, or...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Backlund, I did intentionally exclude those units because they do not have the degree of dependence upon state financing. Obviously, state employees are 100% state-controlled, combination of other funds, federal funds, fees, and so on and so forth. And K through 12 has an extremely high dependence, but counties and cities generate their own resources and have local control and can manage better their expenses within the context of what they can expect and manage for revenue. So, yes, that was specifically excluded.
Senator, can you just take us through what you would envision a school district or some state entity going through this kind of process under this bill? What do you see happening if as far as just the timing, you know, how they negotiate a collective bargaining agreement either before the budget is finalized, you know, if or do they wait and do it all after the budget's finalized? What would you envision? And I guess part of this is, you know, I'm having in mind something that was very fresh, I think, in everybody's mind from yesterday's news was the superintendent of the Willamette Education Services District negotiating a huge compensation package for himself. That's going the distance. I mean, it's going beyond 2 years. Maybe you can reflect on that a bit.
Well, I have not seen those specific numbers. I've heard them. They sound a little bit on the exceptional side. And I wouldn't claim to know the details of how the collective bargaining occurs within the K through 12 districts. I know that they don't all operate on the same cycle. They have beginning and endings. And I've had discussions to the extent that it would create a hardship for the school districts to essentially be all in that same cycle of negotiation at the same time. And that's one of the trade-offs of this kind of legislation, is there would be some adjustments and some challenges to manage this. But there are a host of things in collective bargaining that can be bargained, and you can start that process before the resources are determined, but before you make that final determination on wages and benefits, the actual fiscal impacts, they should be known in terms of what those resources are. So you'd have that period that would probably run up to the beginning of the school year. They might not have those things negotiated by then. But I'm not sure that is an insurmountable task to manage around. And there would have to be a time period that you would allow the districts to come into a cycle, essentially, within the context of their existing bargaining agreements.
Further questions? Representative Barnhart.
I'm getting out of the area that I know much about, and if you don't know about this, just let it go. But I know there's a number of districts that have deferred compensation programs for a variety of reasons. How would this bill becoming law affect the continuation of those deferred compensation programs, if you know?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart, I'm not sure just how it would affect it. I know that if you're talking about the supplemental retirement income,
that's one form, but there are others as well, I think, that different school districts have.
Well, I would suggest that those agreements that are in place, they're probably something that are contractually committed to, and I believe that at least the districts that I'm familiar with, they have those commitments and will honor them.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anything further? The Senator? Okay. Thank you. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Committee members.
Okay, let's call forward John Marshall and Ron Wilson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. John Marshall representing the Oregon School Boards Association. And with me is Ron Wilson, OSBA's Director of Human Resource Development. We're appearing today in opposition to House Bill 3627. We appreciate the efforts of Senator Morse to try to get a handle on the question that schools face every 2 years when the legislature's in session, and that is oftentimes being required to balance a budget without knowing exactly what the legislature's ultimate decision relative to school funding will be. But I think the driving factor behind how school districts operate from a budgetary sense is the requirement that we have a balanced budget. We can't spend more money than we have, and we have to have that budget in place by July 1. So while oftentimes contractual agreements, collective bargaining agreements, may extend into a year where we don't know what resources we will have for that year, most collective bargaining agreements contain provisions that allow us to adjust based on the realities of existing revenue. So, plus the fact that oftentimes when school district boards and their unions sit down together and work out the agreements of a collective bargaining agreement, and particularly one that may extend for a 2 or 3 or possibly even 4 years, the consideration is always given, what if, and I think this question is being asked more often given the uncertainty that school districts have faced over the last year relative to funding, what if the funding doesn't come in at the level that we're currently anticipating? And generally, the board and the union will agree we'll have a provision in our contract to go back and reconsider that. So the discussion, I think, oftentimes is a political decision made bilaterally between a school district and the representatives of the bargaining unit over exactly what the collective bargaining agreement will look like, how much that's going to cost, and how that fits into the confines of not knowing what the revenue might be, perhaps over the course of the duration of the contractual agreement. I'm going to have Ron explain to you some of the logistical problems with this bill, and also provide you with some data that indicates that we believe that school district boards have been pretty responsible over the last 6 or 8 months in terms of the kinds of collective bargaining agreements that they have entered into, and well, he'll share that data with you.
Okay. Thank you. One of the mechanisms...
Can get your name for the record, please.
Sorry. Ron Wilson, Director of Human Resource Development, Oregon School Board Association. John was talking about some of the mechanisms by which during a collective bargaining negotiation, we can structure ways that we can be more responsive to the economic situation. John was referring to funding clauses, which are a relatively technical term for a whole variety of clauses that allow either party, unilaterally or sometimes together, to reopen an agreement and renegotiate. And that's been relatively common, certainly in contracts that have been negotiated over the last couple of years. But probably the most common funding adjustment mechanism has been to have a contract duration of 2, 3, sometimes 4 years, but your economic provisions are not that long. And that part of the agreement is that there will be an annual or every other year negotiation of the economics itself. And those reopeners for economics are not uncommon. So there's a variety of mechanisms that that unions and management and school districts have been able to use to adjust to this. One of the observations, of course, is that this particular bill would indeed require contracts to be about a 2 year length. The average length of teacher contracts now across the state is 2.9 years. And that average has been dropping over the last 4 years. And what we found, not only in Oregon but across the nation, is that contract duration tends to get shorter in times of uncertainty, and in times of economic stability they tend to get a little bit longer. Again, the shorter the contracts reflect that uncertainty of economic times. particularly when the statutory structure that we have under Chapter 243, it can take you anywhere from 9 to 12 months to complete the bargaining process itself. So when you're looking at having to invest in terms of resources that are scarce in the first place into a process that can take up to a year, you're going to want to have a return on that investment that's a little bit longer than 1 or 2 years. And that's why I think in the past we've seen that 3-year duration of contracts. And certainly from the management perspective, the impact of having to do all contracts in a 2-year period with all of the contracts coming open at around the same time is a little bit staggering. As Representative Monis Anderson was mentioning before, there's 198 school districts within the state. About 20 of those districts are so small that they really don't have any collective bargaining agreement. And so that is about 178 districts that remain. Now, most of those districts have at least 2 different types of contracts, one for their licensed teachers and another for their classified staff. So we're looking at the possibility of around 356 or more contracts all being negotiated simultaneously around the state. There are some districts, some of our larger districts, like Portland, for instance, that has like 8 or 9 different classified unions alone. So we're talking quite a bit of bargaining. And just the logistics of trying to do that, I think, would be somewhat staggering for most districts. Our conventional wisdom says that we have negotiated contracts with licensed and classified, do it on the off years, so that you're not doing both together, because the resources of the district and the board end up getting stretched when you're trying to do all of that negotiations. So one of the perhaps unintended impacts of this bill would be to really make resource allocation, time, money, expertise stretch quite thin across the state, I think. One of the other things that that John mentioned was I want to share a little bit of data, and that's from a document that I believe you have a copy of. This is actually a document that I shared yesterday doing a presentation to the Oregon School Personnel Association and looking at some of the recent settlement trends. It's also based on some information that John had requested a little earlier this year. So I took a look at what's happening with recent school district settlements. I took from our database at OSBA and our salary survey, went all the way back to August of last year. And from August of last year all the way up to the current time, the trends are relatively clear. One is that the contract durations are getting shorter. Two is that the cost of living adjustments are going down dramatically, to where a number of the most recent settlements have a 0% increase. There's also another trend which isn't necessarily reflected when you just look at the data. You have to look a little bit farther, is that step increases or step or merit longevity increases, which are a function of the schedule, are also starting to be delayed, with some districts doing delaying steps or in some cases not giving steps at all. So the trends, I think, are that school districts and their unions are being responsive to the economic situation. However, the economic situation, I think, is also decreasing more rapidly than anyone had anticipated. But as these contracts are coming open and they're being renegotiated, I think that you'll see that there are cost controls being put into place. As an example, on the second page, I did a historical analysis of what's happening with district contributions towards insurance. Insurance has been double digit since the 2000-2001 school year. Prior to that point, in school districts, the amount of insurance was increasing at relatively moderate rates, 5% or less. But it was 2000-2001 where school districts were starting to have the double-digit inflation. Now, one of the main cost controls from a district perspective is to place a cap of some sort on the district's contribution. And just looking at the top chart from 2000-2001 to the present, we saw a very steady increase in the number of districts that have a cap on their insurance contribution to the current figure now, which is 88.5% of all districts have some form of a cap. Now, the types of cap vary quite greatly, but it is an indicator that there are cost controls being put in place by school districts. If you look at the other side of the coin, part of that cost control is cost participation and sharing on the part of employees. And we're seeing a parallel increase in the amount of out-of-pocket costs that that school teachers are paid. The bottom graph shows that the increase over the last 4 years has gone from an average of $21 a month to $126 a month out-of-pocket cost by teachers. The system, I think, is being responsive to the economic situation.
Mr. Wilson, let me bring you back to your comment that this bill would require only two-year collective bargaining agreements. What's the basis for that statement?
If I can turn to the bill on Section 2, Subpart 3, a school district, it says a school district may not execute a collective bargaining agreement with the exclusive representative, with the union, in a school district before the Legislative Assembly has appropriated funds to the Department of Education. So the appropriation is for a two-year period and a two-year period only. So I couldn't commit and I couldn't execute a collective bargaining agreement that if that agreement went beyond the duration of that biennial appropriation, according to this section.
Okay, so what I was hearing from Senator Morse earlier was that there were issues in a collective bargaining agreement that do not expend funds or some way, you know, are not reliant upon state funds. And, you know, at least the sense I got from him was that, you know, those things could be negotiated in advance. And, in fact, you could have a collective bargaining agreement go beyond the two-year period that covers those issues, where it's only the funding issues that, you know, need to wait to get the approval before you can actually negotiate those. And is it because, I mean, are you just reading the terminology different? You know, the bill doesn't say what we heard Senator Morse say it does, or, you know, is there something else you're looking at?
The language does not reflect that intent.
Okay.
Because the language of the bill is a straight that a school district may not execute a collective bargaining agreement.
Okay.
There's no provision about economic terms of the agreement or non-economic terms. It's a very broad statement.
Okay. So if we were looking then at a term, you know, that it's, if we're looking at terms related to wages or benefits, for example, I mean, that then would satisfy that concern, or is there something more to it than that?
Which concern?
If there was an amendment, for instance, that would look to executing the terms of a collective bargaining agreement related to wages and benefits, as opposed to just saying, you know, you can't execute a collective bargaining agreement, I mean, would that give you a little more flexibility?
Well, that type of amendment would allow flexibility in terms of having non-economic impacts in collective bargaining agreements. Then the question always becomes, well, what's a non-economic impact?
Right.
And the majority of things that are in collective bargaining agreements have economic impacts.
Okay.
That's one point.
Okay. So if it turns out then that, say, part of the collective bargaining process is where you folks are able to go through this bargaining process and, you know, even coming to terms on, you know, if the state general fund allocation is X, then the wages or benefits will equal Y. You know, if the general fund is Z, then, you know, the package will be A.
Right.
I mean, is that not possible to do in advance?
Those types of formulas and those types of provisions are currently in collective bargaining agreements already. For instance, you can agree, say, in a four-year agreement of the first 2 years, 03, 05, and then have a reopener for the next 2 years. I mean, that emulates the type of concept of that what you're talking about. And yes, that's already present. But the duration of the contract also has an implication on how you can accommodate some of the resource demands, your service demands, and the demands of employees at the same time. With the longer duration, with economic provisions, you can either front-load or back-load the agreement, or you can take a particular financial goal, for instance, in order to recruit more highly qualified teachers, you may want to increase the base salaries at a higher rate than you would that on the top end. And using or having the ability to go more years allows you to spread that liability, even by achieving the same goal, but still over a little longer period of time. So it does and would eliminate those types of solutions to some of the economic issues.
Well, and I guess it's really kind of the crux of this issue is, I'm not advocating the looking prospectively. Because the fact we've done that, I mean, I think although your statistics are reflective of our current economic condition over the last couple of years, I'm sure you would be able to tell us what the increases in salaries were during our boom years over the last 10 years. And again, I'm not making judgment here. I think that as a state, there has been a very strong position by the state of Oregon to make sure that we got as much funding to schools as possible with the revenue we had, and we ended up doing that. And I think in large part, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but when you have these agreements in place that says here's what we're going to pay you for the 2 years of this budget, and then now let's look beyond that to the next year or two after that, that then both the teachers and the school boards and public employees all and their employers come back to the legislature to say, here's where we have negotiated, and so now we need the dollars to fix, to come to that amount. And then it's a matter of the legislature, if they don't give that full amount, and I think over the last 10 years they've pretty well given everything that was asked for, then if that's, I mean, if that happens, then you're fulfilling your contract terms. But it doesn't mean, I mean, you can always come back if the legislature doesn't give you the precise amount, and you can always go back to your collective bargaining and say, okay, we didn't get quite that much, so we now come back to the next level or whatever. Yeah. But I guess what I think Senator Morris is coming to is that, it's who's driving the train. Should the legislature be making the decision on this 2 year period without regard to what has been negotiated beyond that 2 year period?
Right. Well, in a sense, I think it's very clear who's driving the train. The legislature sets the rules; we follow them. The Collective Bargaining Act is a process. Our requirements to have a balanced budget legislatively initiated, so who's driving the train is clear from my perspective. You set up the rules, we follow the rules.
Representative Flores.
As simple as that.
Thank you. Mr. Wilson, in the sub-3 paragraph that you had referred to,
yes,
you say a school district may not, this verbiage says execute a collective bargaining agreement, and then you also use the term negotiate. Now, are they not two separate and distinct procedures,
yes,
if you will?
And I think the execute would mean ratify and sign the agreement, authorize it to actually go into effect. And negotiation is the process that would occur prior to that ratification and signature. So yes, they are two separate things.
Follow up.
Thank you. Were you stating that you object to negotiations beginning prior to receiving the final appropriated funds from the legislature?
No.
Okay, I'm sorry, I must have misunderstood.
No, if I said that, I didn't intend to say it, but we're also talking about some of the dynamics of what's going on right now. Certainly from one perspective, if I don't know how much money I'm going to get, or even when I'm going to get it, or even when the decision is going to be made about when I'm going to get it, what am I going to negotiate about? So there's a natural delay while the legislature comes up with what that appropriation is. And the pattern that I've seen over the last four legislative sessions is those contracts that come open during a legislative year, the beginning of those negotiations have always been delayed until the districts have a little better idea of what those numbers are going to be. This particular year, it's being delayed more. Typically, we would get started in January for a contract that expires in June. And during legislative sessions, we saw that February and March were the more likely start dates. Now it's April and May. Depending upon what the knowledge is of what that appropriation is, could have a significant effect. As well as what's happening in 2002 is now going to be, is reflected in what we're doing in negotiations now. Even if we get an appropriation, like we did for the 01-03 biennium, we don't have any guarantee that that appropriation is what we'll actually receive. So it's really not a question of knowing what that appropriation is, because the appropriation in the final analysis is just an estimate. It's a function of, is there going to be enough revenue in the state? It's also a function of the funding formula that's based on estimates of student population. So from a practical level, though, the provisions that we have to put into contracts, we have to have the ability to be flexible enough on wherever changes are being made, which is why funding clauses and reopeners are really the options of choice at this point from the management's perspective on how to deal with those, because that's not dependent upon time specific, it's dependent upon revenue streams.
Okay, let's go ahead and John, I don't know if you had any follow up on this, but we do have two more panels to come forward in only 20 minutes. So,
Mr. Chairman, just a concluding remarks. The suggestion that somehow the economic issues could be isolated and bargained separately from the non-economic issues in a collective bargaining agreement, I think we'd be very resistant to, because oftentimes when you sit down and bargain, you use the economic to play off against some demands regarding what we call language issues relating to staff assignments, evaluation, grievance procedures, dismissals, and what we've referred to as management prerogatives. And oftentimes, those are traded back and forth. So forcing us to deal with economic issues separately than language, I think, could be detrimental to what finally comes out on the language side.
Okay, thank you. And members, we'll see how the other two panels go. If you want to bring anybody back for questions in the few minutes we might have at the end, we can do that. Or wait, we're not going to work this today, so if we have another chance to review this, then I'm sure they'll be here again. Thank you for your testimony. Tricia Bozak and Tricia Smith.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tricia Bozak, representing the Oregon Education Association. We represent teachers, classified employees, and community college faculty and employees throughout the state. We, too, are in opposition to this bill. I just want to, don't want to belabor what the fellows from OSBA said, but I do want to reiterate a couple of those comments. Currently, collective bargaining agreements can run in varying durations, 2 to 4 years. We too feel like House Bill 3627 would kind of put us in a perpetual bargaining situation the way it's drafted, because if you count on an appropriation, hopefully that's stated, around July 1 of the odd numbered year going into a biennium. Bargaining probably would commence then. I want to echo what Mr. Marshall said. The trade-off between economic and non-economic issues is a very important dynamic at the bargaining table. A lot of time employers, I think it can work to either advantage. When there's not money to be bargained, sometimes employees can make gains in language things, and likewise management too, when there is money to be given in compensation, employees might back off of some language issues that have been important to them. So I think that ability to leave that in the collective bargaining relationship is a very key piece of this. So therefore, I don't think that you would be able to do everything but the economics and then just plug the numbers in place after July 1. I don't think it's very realistic. They would want all those cards on the table. So we do feel like that it would kind of force that two-year agreement, given the length of bargaining as it is in the statute and the natural delays that come in there. I do feel like it would just put us in a constant bargaining cycle. All the contracts being up at the same time, when you get to the end of the timelines in the collective bargaining law, that could put everybody in crisis or bargaining crisis and those kind of things at the same time. I don't think that's a dynamic that we want to see and that we don't see now currently with staggered bargaining agreements. I think the bill also further complicates the requirement for districts to adopt a budget by June 30th. Not only, I think some of the concerns that have been brought is that people don't know the number that they're going to have to work with. I think this last biennium has been a good example of we haven't known the number even when we knew the number. But in addition to that, the school districts wouldn't know what they were going to fund in the bargaining agreement. So I think that just kind of pushes it all off until a later time. These are local decisions that can be made, and I want to echo what Mr. Wilson said. I think this past year has been a pretty public example of some of the trade-offs and sacrifices that have been made, and I think it speaks to the responsibility of the local officials and also the bargainers in the unions who have recognized the financial problems that the state and the school districts face. We've estimated with the lost days, for instance, that have been lost this school year, that employees, teachers, just teachers, not even classified employees, have given up about $35 million in salary just on those lost days, because those are days that they do not work and they are not paid. So that's just one of the things. Also, I think we've seen, Mr. Wilson's correct, we've seen caps on insurances that districts will pay, and that has happened increasingly. Looking at some of the statistics from past years and then to the present, it's over two-thirds of the districts have caps on insurance, so there's increasingly costs paid out of pocket by employees. So I just want to call some of those things to your attention, and I'll close with that.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, a public sector union of 20,000 predominantly classified but also certified school employees working in K-12 ESDs and community colleges all over Oregon. I am here in opposition to House Bill 3627, and because of your time constraints, Mr. Chair, I'll try not to repeat anything that you've heard before from the other witnesses on this bill. I agree with everything that's been said. This is the first moment this session when we're all up here agreeing with each other. It may be the last, but I'm enjoying it for the moment. One thing in trying to visualize, first of all, what this bill might, what the benefit we're trying to achieve in this bill, the only thing I can think is that there's some sense that collective bargaining agreements, the compensation reflected in collective bargaining agreements for my members somehow or another reflects the number that comes to the state school fund, that we are waiting for that number and we say, okay, classified are going to get X in this district because the state school fund has been appropriated $5.2 billion or whatever the number. And that's just simply not the case. I do want to reiterate, though, one point, and I promised I wouldn't repeat, but one point that I would like to reiterate is that school employees all over Oregon have been stepping to the plate, as people like to say these days, for some time, ever since the economy went south, particularly classified employees. And these are people who work two and three jobs to pay the rent. They do not have excessive salaries. They're not driving the school budget through the roof. In fact, I don't hear anybody saying that our budget is excessive. Certainly our salaries are not. There is perhaps one benefit to this bill, and I say this not as the person that organizes our organizers and our bargainers in our union, but it seems to me that we'd be able to, rather than having somewhere around 140 contracts coming up in a 2 or 3 year period, we could have them all up at once, and we could kind of standardize our process, bring our members in all at once, train them all in the same techniques, and maybe we'd have better contracts. But then again, maybe not. I think this would be very complicated for us all, and we have enough trouble educating our kids these days without complicating the process any further with this bill.
Thank you. And like with the others, we'll call back if we have some questions. Thank you. And especially those, Mary Botkin and guest. Ken Allen, sorry. And it is after, especially many of the public employee folks who don't visit Rules or haven't visited Rules for a while, we try to get out by 3 because, as you've all been involved with PERS, you know that usually starts right afterwards. Yep. So we're trying to accommodate that schedule.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Botkin, and I'm here today representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And, you know, I'm kind of the farm team here when it comes to collective bargaining. And today I was lucky enough to corner my executive director, Ken Allen, and have him join me. And then I wouldn't let him leave the hearing room because he actually does do this for a living. I don't. And so I don't want to take the committee's time. I'm just going to introduce you to the executive director of AFSCME Council 75, Ken Allen, and ask him to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Ken Allen. I live in Beaverton. Have been bargaining contracts both in the public and private sector for 29 years in September. And I've been the AFSCME spokesperson for all the state government contracts since 1992. I just want to share a little bit of our history because we had no boom years in state government during the last 10 years. The first 5 years of the time period that Mr. Morse spoke about, we had a five-year wage freeze for all state workers from 1992 to 1997. Since 1997, we have had no yearly increases greater than 3%. So this bill is addressed to us. Trust me, we haven't created a problem. When you're drafting collective bargaining laws, I believe they need to be drafted for both the good times and the bad. And collective bargaining is more, reaching contract settlements is more of an art than it is a science. I think it's a poor move to create artificial barriers to a settlement. I'll just give you an example. Currently, I believe that today's date in the revenue forecast has more to do with when we reach our state settlements and what's in them than any other date. Everybody in state government looks at the May forecast and we adjust to that reality. I'm the leader of our thousands of state workers in negotiations, and I've been preparing them for a settlement that doesn't include wage increases. I happen to think that a settlement prior to June 30th can help our state agencies and this body come to what you need to do about funding than a settlement after June 30th. And this would create a barrier where we wouldn't, unless you're going to guarantee me that you decide all the agency budgets before June 30th, this would create a barrier that we couldn't make an early settlement. Our settlements have given this body the ability to get your budget done and our agencies to plan for the next couple of years. I've been around state employee collective bargaining off and on since 1977, and my belief is that there's only been one settlement that was for longer than a two-year period. We had, AFSCME had one three-year agreement that we executed in 1989, and it went to 1992, somewhere in that time frame. But that's the only agreement that I know of that's been longer than 2 years. Based on my experience in city and county government and state government, longer-term agreements might be a good way to go for state government right now. A four-year agreement where we all agreed that we weren't going to have any wage increase for the first couple of years, but there would be something there for state workers in year three and four, would give them the kind of comfort that would make it easier to agree to the pain that they have to suffer for the first couple years. And I'm talking about that as the leader of a union that we negotiated 5 years of wage freezes in the 90s when the rest of the economy was doing pretty well. So long-term agreements, I think, are a good thing. The other factor for this is our contracts all expire on June 30th with the state. So we perhaps wouldn't be able to get anything done until after June 30th. Some issues, especially in the area of wages, require a longer period of time to address. After the five-year wage freeze, we had lots of classifications that were significantly behind. Our physicians that work in the state hospitals were behind every western state, including Idaho, which is quite an embarrassment. And when when our working physicians are receiving recruitment flyers and telephone calls from the state of Idaho that they can come and work there for $15,000 or $20,000 more a year, it makes it hard to stay here. We had to address those pay issues and catch-up issues. If you can do that over a 3 or 4 year period, that's a lot easier to catch up wages that you're behind than just in a 2 year period. So I'll just give that as an example. If we go through another couple years of a wage freeze, there will be some classifications that have significant recruitment and retention problems because the market hasn't gone through the same wage freeze that we as state workers will have. So I offer that information to you. I'm more than willing to answer any questions about the reality of collective bargaining. I know a couple of you had questions earlier that you might want to ask somebody that does this for a living.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. And we do have just a few minutes, so Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My husband worked in private industry during the 90s, and by and large, his salary increases were in the 2 to 3% range all through the 90s. And he told me that was because that's what private industry across the board was pretty much offering. Are you aware of what, you said that your increases are about 3%. Are you aware of what private industry was offering at that time?
Well, we represent about 1,000 private sector workers, so I'm only aware of those, and it's really dependent on the industry. In Washington County and high tech, people weren't only getting 2 and 3% wage increases. I said that our maximum increase since 1997, we've had no increase larger than 3%. Our increases have been averaged around 2 or 2.5%, the same as what your husband got. But we had 5 years with a zero increase.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. There's been some conversation about economic and non-economic issues and how those are different. And I remember serving on a school board when we were negotiating and thinking about those as if they interacted with each other rather than being really separate issues. Could you comment on that relationship?
Well, the non-economics are supposed to be the things that you bargain over that don't cost anything. And you try to bargain over those first and get them out of the way and then deal with the economic items. But things such as rest breaks, that's an economic item. Of course, all the paid time off that you get, those are economic items. And right now, where we expect to end up with a wage freeze, we're going to try to improve our contract language, which has a non-economic cost to the employer, but provides some more security to the employees. Such things as seniority, better seniority clause, job protection kind of issues, safety and health issues that don't cost the employer anything.
Well, follow up. These are non-economic in the sense that there's no change in the amount of money that changes hands. But they are economic, aren't they, in terms of productivity and perhaps efficiencies and other things of that sort?
Yeah, they definitely could cross over and save money. We're very active on safety and health issues, and as those of you that follow workers' comp costs, the more active we are with the employers at preventing injuries, the lower the workers' compensation costs to the employer. And so we work hard at that with our employers.
Okay. Representative Flores.
Thank you. Mr. Allen, you used the example of physicians in the prison system.
In the state mental institutions.
State mental institutions, and do you have the prison system physicians as well?
We represent all the prison except for, most of the prisons except for the physicians, and it's just a quirk of, they used to be independent contractors, and then the Department of Corrections was found to be inappropriately using independent contractors. And those we organize just the mental health physicians.
I see. And follow up. Mm-hmm. Would you have an example of what that salary might be so we know when they're being enticed away by $15,000, $20,000
well,
or to Idaho?
They were about $80,000 a year several years ago, and over the course of, I think the statistics that I saw recently, they're about $120,000 a year. And for psychiatrists, that's a low figure compared to what they could get outside state service, but it's a figure that's workable because they don't have to pay liability, medical liability insurance. So it's a ballpark figure that they can...
And is there a benefit package that is tied to
sure.
the compensation level then as well?
The only thing tied exactly to their wages would be their PERS benefit.
I see.
Representative Berger, we'll give you the last question.
All right. Thank you very much. In the municipality that I'm familiar with, when economic times became very hard, the AFSCME union was the most cooperative. Their workers worked hand in glove with the municipality. My question to you, though, is what is the difference in having the money up front and knowing some ballpark figure that you can work in and having the figure later?
You know, that's a good question, Representative Berger. We do represent the City of Coos Bay employees, and the local governments usually don't know their have their budgets done until May or early June. And so they don't know the exact figure. Parties that are used to working together can work out collective bargaining settlements, even though you don't know the exact figure, if all the parties are reasonable. We get local government settlements done in May and June sometimes. So it depends on the long-term relationship and the trust between the parties.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, can
yes.
I just remind the committee of one thing? Again, Mary Botkin for the record. Mr. Chair, you and I worked together last session down in Ways and Means, and I want to remind you that most of our budgets have not had a current service level figure to work with for about 3 or 4 bienniums. I know that you and I struggled through several budgets last cycle trying to figure out how to recapture enough savings inside those budgets to keep as many services available both to the inmates and to the staff as possible. And, you know, I just think it's important that when we keep talking about CSL budgets, I haven't seen a CSL budget for so long, I forgot what one looks like. So, you know, let's kind of remember that when we're talking, okay?
Thank you for your testimony. And public hearing on House Bill 3627 is closed, and we are adjourned.